Timmy Himes with Vince Ferrar. Our guest, Dr. Jerry Punch. His appearance brought to you by New Balance Knoxville. Doc, Tennessee goes to Kentucky. Rupp Arena got it handed to him. Your takeaways from Tennessee's loss in Lexington?
Well, played better offensively than they've played in a while. You know, they still haven't played the game like we saw them play against Arizona. That may be the best game I've seen them play this year, without doubt, and maybe in quite a while. But I don't care where you go in college basketball these days. You go up and you play a team that's got some talent, which Kentucky certainly does. They are, you know, this is the oldest team I think that Calipari's had since he's been at Kentucky in terms of experience. And they shoot 67% from the field. You're not going to beat them. I don't care. And then, obviously, you know, Tennessee's got some issues in the blocks. They got issues there. They're getting out rebounded. They can't score as well. And even though you shoot well from outside, and they shot, you know, extremely well from the field, if you can't rebound and you can't score in the blocks, and you're not gonna win many of them. So it's interesting. I see how hard at times that, and I hear about how hard Rick Barnes coaches them, and I'm a huge Rick Barnes fan, and everybody that I've talked to says that, you know, Rick Barnes. I think I saw a quote from Kevin Durant about Rick Barnes is the kind of guy that's going to coach you, and you may not get better by dark today, but you'll be better next week, and you'll be much better next year. He's coaching you to be the best you can be, so you can play next year at whatever level you want to play. And I've been with Rick Barnes before at lunch when the phone rings, and it's KD on the phone, you know, calling to ask him a question. So guys that play at that level in the NBA have that much respect for Rick Barnes and what he teaches them and how he teaches them. I think that should say a lot about the kids that he's bringing in here. And he's got some talent. But he's going to try to get them. I think he's coaching these kids pretty hard, and understandable because he wants them to play better and play to their up to their expectations and abilities. And I think we've seen some growing pains with Tennessee in the last few weeks, especially in some of the games where they've struggled on offense and struggled inside with rebounding.
Doc, Rick Barnes has brought up the difficulty of the schedule numerous times. Including, I guess, today, once again, how tough their road schedule is. Maybe no one's played a tougher road schedule. How much of a factor do you think that is in us judging and viewing this team right now?
Well, I think that you got to remember it's January. It's January, what, 17th? And they, you know, the basketball teams change a lot over a period of a few weeks. I think you'll see a team that matures, in my opinion, and plays better a month from now, two or three weeks from now. But I think the last few weeks, the schedule has taken its toll. COVID has taken its toll. Several players, two or three players have been under the weather. You're trying to come back and battle back. You don't have the touch. You don't have the stamina. You don't have the strength you had to play. That impacts, you know, in this game, it's not a half a step, it's a quarter of a step, and someone steals the ball from you. You don't have to slow down much. You don't have to, and suddenly you start to dribble left and the ball bobbles a little bit and it's gone. Being physical inside. I think it's taken its toll. But I think that schedule early in the year, as tough as it was, you know, the Texas Techs and the Villanovas and people like that you play, you know, Arizona, you know, how good is Arizona? My goodness, people are asking, on game day, they're asking, how in the world did Tennessee beat Arizona? Well, I watched the game. I sat a few rows from the floor and was so impressed. But I think those kind of games help you learn and develop, and I think it's got to be frustrating for Rick Barnes as much as it is for his players to know that we've got this potential right now. We just can't put it on the floor and put it together. And he's trying to. And right now, while people are trying to get their legs under him or find out if they're going to be able to get in there and rebound and battle, he's looking for combinations, looking for people who go out there and step up and play. And I think he's finding some people that he can get some valuable minutes out of. And I think he's trying to push some others to try to get back where they need to be.
Rick Barnes and some players have talked about toughness. They need to be tougher. How difficult is it midstream to increase a team's toughness within individual players and as a whole?
Well, I think you saw that LSU, in spite of the officiating, which was so poor in Baton Rouge, that LSU just beat them up. LSU came in and just pushed and shoved. They were elbowing and pushing and shoving, you know, Fulkerson inside. Now LSU goes to, where'd they go to? Florida a few days later, and they foul out half the team because those officials called those physical. But yeah, people are going to play physical with Tennessee, and I think that's the MO. They said we go in and we play physical in Tennessee and man them up. then we've got them, because they won't be able to do much inside anyway, and they won't be as aggressive on the rebounding offensively or defensively. And if they're cold outside, they're not going to score. They may keep us from scoring, but they're not going to score, so we'll still beat them. So I think that's that you know, you got to play tough. Now, you know, here's the problem in the NCAA tournament. You play one game where the officials are calling touch fouls, and another game where you have to have a compound fracture to get a foul called. So it's, you know, there's no consistency in watching officiating. You watch a Gonzaga game or a Baylor game, and they allow them to play physical, and you watch a game, watch a North Carolina game or an ACC game, and they're calling touch fouls. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you prepare for what's going to happen, and you know, week after week. And there's such a wide discrepancy. And I'm not knocking officials. I mean, I know that is an impossible job, because you're not going to make anybody happy. There's a tremendous discrepancy between games or among games from during the week, just within officiating in the same conference. I mean, I realize these officials move around the country, but there's a tremendous discrepancy in how things are called.
But don't you think part of toughness is being able to adjust to that adversity that you get and respond to it?
Yeah, you got to be able to do that. When you get shoved, you got to be able to go back and give it right back to them. If you turn your back and run down the floor, and they're going to keep doing it until it's like a bully. You know, until you step up, stand up to them, you know, they're going to keep pushing and shoving, especially if they believe. And I think there are several teams. I heard this from a couple of guys that call games on ESPN. There are several teams in the SEC that believe if you beat on Tennessee, that you got them beat, because they're not going to beat back. And I think that's time for Tennessee to step up and be physical back. They've got people who can be physical. They're not small. They're not weak. They work out like everybody else does. You just got to show them you can do it, and you will do it.
Doc, is it a concern when it is said that your two best leaders are Juroš Plavšić and Jamal Mašić, two guys that are not among your better players?
Well, you know what? Not now, but I tell you, Plavšić, I mean, how do you not love the effort he shows on the floor? And he's getting more minutes because he's out there with a lot of want to. Now, does he hang on to the ball when you pass it to him? Sometimes, maybe not, but he's going up and getting the rebound, coming down with it, playing physically. And here's the other thing. How much do they push him around? Not much, because he's a presence out there. He pushes back. Now, he may get a couple of fouls, but when he turns that big body with those elbows, they go flying across the floor. Now, you know, some officials may call things flagrant, which I would disagree with, especially when he didn't really touch anybody. But that's the difference, is people will go out there and play physical and man up, and they don't get. And I think that's because of effort and intensity. And I wondered how much was Plavšić would be on the floor, but he's getting more and more minutes because of what he's doing. He may not outscore anybody, but he certainly does it with effort and rebounding and presence, which I like.
Let's go to Gene. Gene, you're on with Dr. Punch.
Hey, Dr. Punch, how are you?
I'm good, Gene. How are you?
I'm great. I just wanted to say that I caught your podcast with Dale Jr. a couple of days ago. I sat down and listened to it, and I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you.
And I hope that Knoxville realizes how lucky we are to get to listen to you on Monday afternoon. So a lot of people don't even get to hear from you, and we're very fortunate in doing so. And my question to you is what you can tell us about the next gen car and what kind of racing you think we're going to see. Closer racing, is it going to be some of the same what we've seen in the past couple of years, or do you think the improvement's going to help the quality of racing we see?
Yeah, I really thought, Gene, let me ask you before I answer the question, what did you think of the racing you saw, say, from midseason on last year on the track? I mean, what was your impression? My personal opinion, I thought we saw some really good racing at the end of the year last year, and it was really very, very competitive no matter where they were.
There was some good racing there, but there's still, like, at Bristol's not, well, other than the dirt race, the regular Bristol racing, I wasn't pleased with it. It was better this past year.
Right.
I'll give you that, but it's still not to where it used to be, and I don't know if we'll ever get there. But maybe it's because of the way they're repaving the tracks now, and I feel like maybe sometimes we try to go and stretch the limits too much.
Right. Well, let me answer your question. You know, from what I heard from Daytona, the adjustments they made on the car, they decided on the 510-7 package, which is 510 horsepower and a 7-inch spoiler at Daytona. And there was a lot of drafting, and the suck-up rate, what they call it, the overtake rate, was really high. So cars could get in the draft and just run down the leader or run down one car or several cars and go by them. And there was also a thing where they thought the tandem-type drafting, although they wouldn't hook up much, a couple of veterans implied that this tandem draft, like we used to have a few years ago at Talladega, could come into play again. Some people liked it, some people didn't, and that could be a factor. The cars apparently looked good, and the drivers said they were a little bit of a handful, but not as much as they're going to be on some other tracks. I think they've improved it for Daytona. And I think we'll see I think one of the concerns among the drivers is the suck-up rate is okay when you're just practicing and everyone's playing nice. But in the Daytona 500, people start blocking, you're going to end up with some pretty big ones. And these cars are going to overtake each other. It's going to be hard not to block.
I know they've been testing at Charlotte and Atlanta, and that's the type of tracks that I was most concerned about.
Right.
What kind of? Yeah. They're talking about the tires not wanting to push the car to the wall. And
right, but that was an issue with trying to pass it. That's one of the things they were trying to work on at Charlotte on the earlier tests. Is you couldn't get really close to somebody without a car going up to cross the wall, and you couldn't when you caught someone, you couldn't get right up on them because there was some aero issues, which are things we've been having with the other car. But I think they've got more ways to fix it with this car. And answer your question, I don't know in this. I know they went and tested tires, and Kurt Busch was really fast at Atlanta, but I don't know what they found out about the next gen car at Atlanta in terms, or did they have enough cars there to know what it's going to do in traffic? I know that is a concern, and that was an issue they were working on, and as of yet, I have not heard what they found.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr.
Bunch. Jim, we appreciate it. Thanks for the call. When we come back, we'll continue to take your phone calls. To join us, 656-9900, 1-866-656-9900. Let's go to the phones where our next caller is Lynn. Hello, Lynn.
Hey, good afternoon, guys.
Afternoon.
Dr. Punch, I know you don't like to talk about yourself, but I know that you were in somewhere this weekend getting an award. Tell us a little bit about that award.
Well, you're kind, Lynn. I was in the Detroit, Michigan, the Motor City over this weekend. My wife Joni and I went up, and I was honored with a Lifetime Achievement Award for Motorsports Broadcasting. So it was nice to go up there, and in spite of the fact that it was 6 degrees outside, they had probably got 300 or 400 people show up at this award ceremony. It's called the Eddie Sachs Memorial Lifetime Achievement Award. Eddie Sachs, who's the NASCAR, the IndyCar driver who lost his life in Indianapolis in a fiery crash, way too young. I think he was 37 years old at the time, so way too young. But his son, Eddie Sachs II, gives the award. It's voted on each year, and so I felt honored to get it. But Bob Jenkins, my colleague, longtime colleague that we lost this year after a battle with cancer, he had gotten it a few years ago. So to be in that category, that being getting honored by motorsports people and fans and organizations, and then being the same, getting that along with Bob Jenkins was special to me.
Yeah, I can understand that, and certainly well deserved on your part. And just speaking of motorsports, I saw a very exciting motorsports event Saturday evening, and it was at the Chili Bowl. But are you familiar with this, what they call the pole shuffle?
I am not. I want to go to the Chili Bowl sometime, but I haven't ever been able to. I've got people who have invited me out there, but I have not. Why don't you explain to people how that works?
Well, the shuffle, they take the top 10 qualifiers, and they qualify through these heat races, and I'm not sure how they, 1 through 10. But they take the first race is 4 laps with 4 cars. It's rows 7, 8, 9, and 10, or positions 7, 8, 9, and 10. They run 4 laps, and the 2 cars that finish in front advance to the next sprint. And there's no break. There's no going to the pits. It's right on the track. Then they go up and race the next 2 cars ahead of them. and then that just repeats till they work themselves through the system. And I don't know, Tanner Thorson was either in the eighth or ninth row when it started out, maybe the seventh, I'm not sure. But anyway, he was toward the back, and it took a couple of those for me to realize, hey, this guy's got something tonight. And he ran, I guess he wound up second or third, and he'd been toward the back when that started. But it was exciting to watch. I bet the whole thing was over in 15 minutes. They never, there was no pit stop. There was no repairing the car. If you wrecked it, you were just out. None of that happened. But it was exciting to watch, and I've been thinking about how NASCAR could do something like that and don't think they could, you know.
Right.
But it sure added a dimension to it that I really liked.
Did you see Kaylee Bryson, the young lady who made history?
No, I missed that. I did not see the B-Main, but I've read a lot about it. I hadn't heard much about her. But, boy, she must be something else.
Well, let me explain to people. At this Chili Bowl is held in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's held indoors, and there are 400 cars trying to make the show. They house them inside a civic center, a convention center, indoors. That's where they pull your truck, and you have a little spot to work on your car. This year there were 394 cars entered, and this 20-year-old named Kaylee Bryson, B-R-Y-S-O-N, became the first female ever to make the Chili Bowl A Main, the primary race. She made it for the first time in the 35-year history of this race. And so I don't know a lot about her either, but my daughter was texting and saying how proud she was because she had watched. My daughter obviously works in motorsports, and she was in Columbus, Ohio, doing an event over the weekend, and they were all watching. They said, you got to find out about her because she is a talent, and she is going to be moving up quickly.
Yeah, that was something to, all of that was just so exciting to watch. And Chase Elliott got in a wreck, and they keep up with the flips. Those midgets, evidently, that's pretty common for them to flip during a race. They had 50-some flips during the week, and his was about as scary as any I saw.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but I saw a replay, and wow. Yeah, the midgets, because of when they dig into the cushion and hit, or they get another wheel over another, because if you dive under somebody in the front of the car, because of the horsepower, you jump back into throttle, the front of the car bobs a little bit, and that left front tire comes up, and you happen to hit somebody, you're going to start somersaulting. You're going to get in the air. And boy, you're glad you're inside that metal cage, even though you're like a pea inside a whistle bobbling around in there, and you're fortunate if you don't break something.
Yeah, I think that'd be a fun event to go to. If you ever get to go and looking for a partner, you holler at me because I'd go and carry your suitcase for you.
All right, buddy, I want to go. I've got some friends here in town that are big open wheel guys that have been trying to get me to go to some of the races, and I definitely want to go with them, and I'm going to go sometime this summer.
Hey, Lynn, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Let's go to Nick. Nick, you're on with Doc Punch.
Good afternoon, guys. How y'all doing?
Doing well, Nick.
Good, good. I've got a question for Dr. Punch.
Yes, sir.
I just saw that Dale Jr. had been testing the next-gen car at Daytona. And, of course, I know he's racing the Xfinity Series at Martinsville. And
right.
Looking forward to going up and seeing that. But obviously, your mind gets clicking. Maybe he'll, get back in the Cup car. I know he said he never would. But do you think there's any possibility maybe that he could race the Cup car at Richmond or Bristol or Martinsville or something maybe in the future?
Well, I wouldn't say, the easy answer is I don't know. Now, I will tell you this, Nick, I'm going to be with him on Friday. I'm going to be at the NASCAR Hall of Fame Friday night where he's inducted in the Hall of Fame, and he and Mike Stefanik and Red Farmer. So I will be there, and I'm going to ask Junior. I haven't had a chance to talk with him since in probably a couple months since we did our Dale Junior download. I did talk to him a little bit over Christmas, but not much. But it wasn't about racing. But anyway, I'm going to find out what he has to say. The last time I spoke with him, I think there were some promises he made to family that when he walked away, he was going to stay away. And that's hard, especially when you're in his position and everybody wants you back in the car. But I think the people who care enough about him, his wife and the Rick Hendricks and people like me and others, are probably going to tell him, you go run that Xfinity race at Richmond, but I think your days in the Cup car, because of what he went through, not because he doesn't want to, but because what he went through with the concussion, how long it took him to recover, the next time he may not recover. And so I think that's something.
Right.
He's a dad now. He's a husband and a dad and a car owner and a businessman, and he's got a lot more going on than climbing in a car, as much as he'd like to do it, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had always been a huge Junior fan, and obviously very selfishly, I'd love to see him back in the Cup car. And then obviously I know he probably never would at, you know, arguably two of his best tracks, Daytona, Talladega. But man, it'd be super cool to see him in a Cub car at Bristol again, you know, local track. But
yeah,
I understand that, you know, with injuries and concussions, that it's I think it's something that, you know, the racer in him, he would obviously love to do. But like you said, the dad and the husband and obviously those being the most important, but the businessman, that he probably wouldn't risk that.
And like I said to him, you know, your family, the Earnhardt family, has given enough. I mean, you guys have given so much to the sport.
Absolutely.
Your grandfather and your dad and all that they meant to the sport and have meant and will continue to mean for decades to come. You've given a lot. So you don't owe them anything. You be a car owner, you be a broadcaster, you be a dad, you be a husband, and you enjoy it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, his impact is obviously just continued greatly even after getting out of the Cub car in 2017. But I just wanted to touch base and see what you thought about that, and enjoy listening to the show and enjoy your segment, and just fantastic. And y'all have a great day.
Nick, we appreciate it. Thanks for the call. Doc, what's this week look like for you?
Headed to the NASCAR Hall of Fame Friday night. Going to go over there to be a part. I was a voter in the early years selecting the Hall of Fame members, and I've always enjoyed being a part of that. And, you know, it's my daughter, Jessie, who works for NASCAR, is going to go with me, and we'll sit there. We're going to they have the awards banquet an hour before, and then they have the live telecast on NBC or NBC. It used to be NBCSN, which doesn't exist. It's on NBC now, or maybe USA Network. I'm not sure where they'll put it. But it will with the actual induction. And Dale Earnhardt Jr., Red Farmer, legendary Red Farmer, who we're not sure how old he is. We know he's somewhere between 85 and 103, as Red puts it. And then the late Mike Stefanik, who was an incredible open wheel modified driver, and they will be inducted. Bob Jenkins, the late Bob Jenkins, will be getting the Squire Hall Award, named after Barney Hall and Ken Squire, for broadcasting. So I want to be there to help support his family and the memory that of him being such a great colleague to me all these years.
And, Doc, congratulations on your Lifetime Achievement Award that you got in Detroit.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I was very honored and humbled that people like that, who are diehard fans, would ask me to be to get that award.
Doc, we appreciate it.
Look forward
to seeing you next week.
We'll talk next Monday, guys. Thanks.
Dr. Jerry Punch, his appearance brought to you by New Balance Knoxville. They are the fit specialists. Buy local. You can find them at the Suburban Shopping Center. Over the weekend, the Tennessee Vols go to Rupp Arena, and Kentucky hands it to them, 107-79. They shoot 79% in the first half, 68% for the game. A lopsided victory for Kentucky. Afterward, Rick Barnes met with the media. Here comments from Coach Barnes.
Yeah, Rick, obviously that was a tough day, and I know you haven't seen film yet, but and you'll probably have a better idea when you do, but how much of that was just a bad day, or was that a cause for bigger concern?
Well, I think it was a great day for Kentucky. It was almost like they had a magnet in the rim, and they were doing it. But with that said, I didn't think we started the game defensively the way we wanted to with our scout report. But with all that said and done, you know, we were in the kind of game we thought it would be, and then we turned the ball over there. They get those four quick points. It was really a two-possession game. I think we were down six, maybe seven. We turned it over twice at half court where we shouldn't have. And then now you're – and momentum turns that way. You simply can't give a team this good that many points off turnovers. They're going to shoot 80% if you let them get those run-out dunks and those run-outs where they were getting to the corner, and they're going to shoot it. And when they're making those shots – it's tough, but the turnovers were a big part of the game. But with that said, you know what? I really believe that in some way, I've got to look at it this way, that we're going to learn a lot. It's going to be positive. We can be positive from it, take some positive from it. And I really was proud of Urosh. I thought that he's real in the way he goes about it. Brandon Huntley, 2 days ago, finally decided that we felt he let his guard down. He has spent 2 days on his own with coaches, really saying, hey, you got to help me do this. And I'm so proud of him, because he's had 2 days where he's really, you can tell he's just been totally different than any point up to here. Not so proud he went to the game and did what he did. Shaq goes in and he brings every night the energy he's learning out there. But our point guard position tonight, backcourt, they scored, 49, 59 points, somewhere in there with our backcourt. We've got to do a better job. I got to do a better job. I mean, there's no question about that. But the fact is, we've got to really look at it and see what we do. Maybe it's changing the vibe of our team, whatever it may be, whatever that may be. But we're going to have to take what we learned here today and certainly learn from it, because, again, I'm not – you can say it was a bad day. We allowed them to get going. We really did. And at the start of the game with our defense, just made it way too easy for them. And then, again, we fought back, you know, kind of game you think it would be going here. But those turnovers at half court, those four quick points, I thought was a big turning point in the game.
Rick, what did you see that led to Olivier and Funky struggling tonight?
The rebounds at the end of the game. I mean, you're starting front line. Can't play. John played 20 minutes. Olivier played, was it 16 or 18?
16.
They can't play. I mean, without rebound, they got to rebound the ball. I mean, that's their job. And they've got to do that. So that's a big part of it. I still, with Olivier, again, he keeps getting himself in trouble on offense. They had six turnovers between them, because on offense, honestly, and I just told them this, they're not listening to what we tell them. We know how people are going to game plan them, and we tell them where they're going to be able to be effective. And that's where they've got to really, truly not only lock into what we're talking about on our defensive end, but the offensive execution. They've got to understand that part of it. But if you narrow it down to one thing, you can't have 36 minutes out of a front line and no rebounds.
Hey, Coach, without seeing the film, you probably can't answer this, but and you touched on it with the turnovers, but also thought Kentucky had a lot of open shots in the half court. Where did you see your breakdowns, Kevin?
Well, I thought one early in the game, because of the way we allowed them to, we didn't execute our ball screen. We didn't X our personnel coverage early in the game. We didn't do that. And then, you know, they got going, and then we were trying to adjust with some of our coverage. But you're right, Rob, they knocked us back on our heels once they got the lead. But it started really the first couple of plays of the game where we absolutely gave no resistance. And then from there, we're trying to just subtle adjustments within our man offense. You know, we were thinking about, do we want to go zone? The way they were shooting the ball today, we were most concerned about rebounding there. And at the time, with what we were getting from our front line, we didn't feel like we had a zone team out there that we could put that could really maybe rebound the ball from our zone positions. But again, it started from the get-go. Our defense was not good from the get-go, and again, that's on me.
Yeah, Rick, who's kind of a player on this team you would expect to go into practice this week and say to everyone, the way some things have gone lately isn't acceptable? I mean, who's the one who will do that and kind of really get into their teammates on how some things have gone lately?
Well, throughout the game, the guy that's most real in that whole – the two guys that most real when you're talking about that are without question, are Urosh and Jemai Meshack. They're the ones that when they talk, it's very authentic. Players know players, and maybe that's where we are. You know, I don't know. But people will say, well, I think Zakai has gotten that kind of respect if he wanted to do it, but he hasn't. I mean, it's tough to ask freshmen to do that. Santi, maybe, and to really mean it, I mean, this is when you hope some of that's developed, I would say. To answer your question, Mike, if you ask me of the guys that started, I'm not sure. if I can pinpoint any one of them, maybe that's going to be a great lesson for us. Somebody will decide, hey, enough is enough. This is what we need. This is how we need to go about this.
Rick, with this January schedule being what it is, do you worry about your team's confidence getting out of this month with confidence intact?
We're a pretty good team. We get our back against the wall. We've always been that way. And again, there's a lot of guys. I've said to you guys before, I mean, we got our tails kicked today any way and every way that you could. But other than that, we've had chances in most every game we've been in. Again, I would say Villanova game, maybe not. But we got today what we deserve because we did not execute defensively the way we're capable of. But again, I don't want to take anything away from Kentucky. They're shooting the ball well. They're a team that they bought into their roles. I think they're playing their roles very well. But hey, it's a long way to go. And I said before this, I wanted us to play our best game today, but I think that we're going to be better a month from now. And again, we're still in good shape with where we are, but we're going to find out about a lot of different things. Like I said, I think some way, somehow, we've got to change the vibe with our team, and what that may be, I will determine that more after I watch the tape.
Just going back to Mike's question, how frustrating or big of a problem is that the two guys you have confidence in to kind of step up in a leadership role are two guys that I think average less than 12 minutes a game?
Well, at the end of last year and at the start of this year, all we talked about was leadership. And again, and I believe it or not, through the offseason with guys leading and talking, we probably were as good as we've been in a long time, to be quite honest with you. Last couple of years, we haven't had it the way you want it. But we're going to find out. Like I said, there can be a lot of positives that can come out of something like this. And the fact of the matter is we will find out. Maybe this is what we're going to find out. Who is going to be the people to step up and do it? But mean it when they say it. And the only way you can say it is that if you're willing to go out and guys know that you've earned a right to have that voice. But if you're going to say it, you got to back it up.
Rick, piggybacking off what you said about Brandon, was there any thought to playing him earlier in the game, given John and Olivier's struggles and how he played in those final minutes? Does that merit enough to play him more going forward?
There is no question he's going to play more. But I told you, I'm proud of him because you know what? Two days ago, he finally understood, I think, more than ever that, hey, I can't do this by myself. He's locked in. His whole persona has changed in 2 days. And early in the half, the reason I didn't, one, we're trying to fight, and I didn't know if I wanted to put him in there and us keep sliding backwards, and it hurt his confidence going forward. I do hope that, and again, he made some plays tonight that he can't make. He still wants to swipe at the ball. He still gives up position by just reaching and those type things. But forget all that. It's what he did the last 2 days in practice in terms of his whole personality has changed in terms of, hey, help me. I do want to do this. I think he, like a lot of young kids coming in, they have a guard up sometime, but what he has done on his own after practice, came back at night, like I said, the coaches, and went harder than he's ever gone. And now I hope he will continue to with that same attitude and moving forward that way.
Rick, you've obviously been at Rupp multiple times now, and you know how tough of a place that is anyway. With the passing of Joby Hall, could you tell, was there even more emotion at the start of that game than there even typically is?
I think there's a lot of emotion. I don't know if it was because of that. I think the fact that we've won, two out of 3 years here, I think that's a lot of motivation for anybody, coming in when you've had a team to do that, huh? But, again, it's very, sad day, not just here, but in the basketball world. I mean, Joby Hall, when I was getting into coaching, he was at the end of it, but everybody knew what the job he had done here, and obviously being here under Coach Rupp as well. But prayers go out to his family, and it's tough, even when you've had someone with you 93 years, and when they're gone, you certainly miss them.
That's Rick Barnes, his postgame comments after Kentucky beat Tennessee 107-79 in Rupp Arena. Vince, we heard from Rick Barnes postgame. He took blame for some of the defensive woes. What do you think they were? Do you think they were supposed to back off of Shavar Wheeler? Do you think we're not switching properly? What do you think the defensive breakdowns were?
Well, it sounded like some of their assignments, especially on ball screens, that they didn't handle those well. I know that them allowing all those straight line drives to the basket was terrible. Because what would happen is that Oscar Tshiebwe is such a presence, even if he's not rebounding 20 boards per game, Tennessee's bigs wouldn't leave him. So there was no help side. Mm-hmm. So you got these straight drives to the basket, and no one's coming over to help. So they're just getting to the rim easy. So I wonder if they're either supposed to go under screens or give them a little bit more space to try to bait them into more of those perimeter shots, especially Wheeler, because a lot of other guys were hitting three-pointers. So, I don't know what that means. That may be just him adjusting to maybe some criticism that he took for criticizing his team and saying it's on me, because he hasn't always said that. But we didn't really get a whole lot of specifics on that.
We always hear coaches say, yeah, we got problems, but they're fixable. Are Tennessee's problems fixable?
Long term, Jimmy, I'll say no, because the toughness thing, like we were talking about with Doc Punch, mm-hmm. that's hard to fix during the season. Leadership, when the two players that you're asked about who holds other players accountable are guys that get like 12 minutes or less per game, and he couldn't really think of a starter that he could put into that category. How do you change that midstream? That's tough. Plus, yeah. Two big flaws of this team is post offense. And I think, and this might even go back to recruiting, and maybe Brandon Huntley Hatfield will fall in this category. I don't think Tennessee has been athletic enough in the post in today's basketball. Like, so often Tennessee either gets shots blocked or missing at the rim. So many teams have really athletic, bouncy, long bigs that can get back up and either finish or block shots or whatever. And I think Tennessee doesn't have that. They might in Brandon Huntley Hatfield, but he's got to play. Now, I know Barnes wants him to earn his mm-hmm. minutes. So that could be something that could potentially improve a little bit. So those are all things that I think are really tough to finish. To change midstream, and then where's the scoring when they have these droughts? I mean, even the two games, that's why I don't buy the schedule thing, Jimmy, that's the reason why this team has struggled. Even the two home games they won in conference, they didn't play that well. And they had a long drought. They didn't score through the first TV timeout against South Carolina. It was like one basket and two TV timeouts against Ole Miss. So they haven't played that great even in those games against lesser competition. So yep. This isn't a tough opponents. It's going to happen. It'll get better. Oh, by the way, the schedule is still going to remain tough moving forward.
I think that there'll be moments where they show flashes of being really good like they did against Arizona, but the consistency will not be there.
Yeah.
So, all right, that's Vince Ferraro. I'm Jimmy Himes. When we come back, we will have more. We'll bring you postgame comments from the Lady Vols victory. We've got more Tennessee basketball coming your way as well. Again, Rob Lewis, who usually joins us at 5:05, under the weather, we will try to reschedule him. 5:35, we'll be joined by Vols tennis coach Chris Woodruff. Sports Talk 99.1, the sports animal.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.